Welcome to the Court of Appeals for November 15. We have six matters on our calendar today, three oral and then three non-oral. And we are recording this proceeding and live streaming it as well, but the recording it will be on the court's website within 24 hours. But for both of those reasons, we do remind counsel to identify your name when you approach the podium and who you are representing. And with that, counsel for appellant, our file, I'll note first for the record, 823-0182 is the first case, State of Minnesota versus Ali Daib Warsami. And counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of Appellant Ali Warsami. Mr. Warsami is entitled to withdraw his invalid Norgard plea because when he entered it, it was not based on a sufficient factual basis. A valid Norgard plea, as this court is well aware, requires the defendant's agreement that the evidence is sufficient to support his conviction and a strong factual basis that allows a court to independently conclude there's a strong probability that the defendant would be found guilty of the charge to which he pleaded. Here, that is not present. The Supreme Court has made it very clear that district courts should not accept Norgard, Alfred pleas cavalierly and should accept them with caution. That's not what happened here. Here, although Mr. Warsami acknowledged in general that the evidence would be sufficient to convict him, the record doesn't contain a strong factual basis that would allow a court to independently conclude as such. And this is especially true in light of the statement that he made negating intent. He was.
Lockwood, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
As a district court judge, pretty much the process was followed here is what I would generally follow, and it was my understanding that as long as the evidence that it was the state would use is identified and the defendant has reviewed it, and acknowledges that therefore is a substantial likelihood that I would be convicted, or found guilty, I should say, that would be sufficient in terms of the record. Is there any case law that has said that the actual documents need to be not only offered and received, but independently reviewed by a judge to mean that there therefore has been the record reviewed by a judge in that method?
Yes, Your Honor. This court's opinion in State v. Johnson is instructed. That is a Norgard factual basis situation. And in that case, this court made it clear that a court must ensure a strong factual basis, although not required to make an express finding as such. That was the issue in Johnson, that the district court didn't expressly say, I find the evidence in the record is sufficient. We have the same situation here. The district court made no such finding. The district court did not find the plea was voluntary, accurate, or intelligent, nor based on a sufficient factual basis. But in Johnson, this court went further to explain that a valid factual basis for a Norgard plea requires a district court to independently conclude and must assure itself that there's sufficient evidence that would be substantially likely to secure a guilty verdict at trial.
Johnson, can you refresh my memory? Was evidence actually received and then independently reviewed by the court, or did our court say that's what should have happened?
In Johnson, that is what happened. In Johnson, the issue was there was not an express finding made. This court said an express finding from the district court that there was sufficient evidence isn't necessary so long as a review of the record indicates the district court had sufficient evidence in the record to make that finding. And Johnson even went further to state that express finding is not necessary unless the plea is challenged. It said if this defendant had, in Johnson, had made a motion to withdraw his plea, then the district court would be required to review the record and make that explicit finding based on the evidence in the record that there was a substantial likelihood of a conviction. That's exactly what we're asking this court to do here. Under your de novo standard of review, you sit in the same position as a district court in reviewing the record of this plea. and in reviewing the evidence that formed the basis of the state's case against Mr. Warsami, there's not sufficient evidence to prove he knowingly possessed ammunition, especially in light of the statements he made negating guilt. Not only do...
When you say he made statements negating guilt, are you... Tell us what you're referring to, please.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm referring to page... I believe it's page 13 in the transcript when Mr. Warsami is specifically asked... whether he knew it was ammo. He's asked by the prosecutor, "You knew that was ammo." Mr. Warsami states, "I didn't know. I mean, I've seen the video, so yes, it was ammo." That statement, Mr. Warsami is specifically saying he didn't know at the time, but now knows after reviewing the video that the item sitting behind him on someone else's bed in someone else's room happened to be ammunition. That does not indicate at the time he knew as such. In fact, it indicates just the opposite.
But isn't that consistent, read in context, with the Norgard plea? In other words, a Norgard plea, you can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would, I don't know, because I don't know what happened, but now I've looked at the video, and yes, I would likely be convicted. Isn't that the process that's sufficient under a Norgard plea?
No, Your Honor, it's not. A Norgard plea is not someone asserting innocence like an Alford plea. A Norgard plea is someone asserting a lack of memory due to amnesia or intoxication. And we know in this case it was due to intoxication at the time. And here, he did not indicate, "I wasn't sure it was ammo," or "I was too intoxicated to remember at the time." He specifically negated that intent. "You knew it was ammo," was the question. "I didn't know." And then qualified it by saying, "After seeing the video, now I know." That clearly indicates at the time he did not know that was ammo next to him.
I'm having trouble with that distinction because, again, the end result's the same, and whether it's Alford or Norgard is either I'm pleading, professing innocence, but, or here I can't remember, but I've looked at the video. Now, if he had looked at the video and then said, "No, I wasn't possessing," that might be a stronger argument. Just that one sentence in line with everything else he said, that he's making a gun, and yep, yes, yeah, I know it was leading questions, I realize, but it seemed to hit the elements. I'm not getting the distinction of how that would be different than any standard, well, we'll call it unstandard plea because it's a Norgard plea. What more would need to be done by the judge?
There needs to be sufficient evidence discussed, at least, and available to the court that meets the elements of this offense, and there's not. This is not a plea that met the elements of the offense. The elements of this offense are knowing possession of ammunition. He not only has to be in proximity of that ammunition, but he has to knowingly have the ability to exercise dominion or control and intend to do so. So if he made this statement, as he did, negating guilt, say, "I didn't know it was ammunition," then the state was required to either have him withdraw that statement or correct that statement.
But didn't the state correct that statement when, I mean, in my reading of the transcript, the state then goes on to summarize the video and then asks him if he agrees that if the jury saw that evidence, there would be a likelihood that he would be convicted of the offense. Why isn't that enough to correct whatever earlier statement he had made?
That brings up the issue with leading questions and pleas, and even in Norgard pleas. I'm going to read that specific statement here from the prosecutor.
Well, can you answer that question assuming that... Can you answer Judge Larson's question assuming without regard to the fact that it's a leading question? I mean, set aside whether it's appropriate to have a leading question or not, is this his answer that yes to that, acknowledging what the video showed?
No, and here's why. This prosecutor's characterization of a video that was not entered into evidence or available to the judge is not evidence. It's only evidence as much as the defendant adopts that statement. It's only factual basis for his plea so much as he adopts that statement. So the statement is very important. It's a compound, confusing question based on a characterization summary of this video. The prosecutor tells Mr. Warsami, Okay, so the video shows the police coming in, sitting on the bed, you're holding the parts. And then when you're talking with police, you make statements to them about, it was a rifle, it was ammo, you were building it, it's not worth doing 60 months over this or what you were doing. So you understand that if the jury saw that evidence, there's a likelihood they would convict you of this offense. He answered yes. This prosecutor is characterizing a video that's not in evidence that the judge has never seen and is telling Mr. Warsami it shows something like you saying it was ammo. Do you agree if a jury saw that evidence that I just told you about and characterized, you'd be found guilty?
But didn't Mr. Warsami say it just prior to that that I've seen the video? I'm looking at the transcript and that's what he said. So it's not, I mean, he's... has an understanding of what the video shows on his own. It's not just the prosecutor posing a question.
And in that question, Mr. Warsami is not agreeing that the prosecutor's summary of the video is accurate to what he saw. The prosecutor does not ask Mr. Warsami, is that what the video shows? He asked Mr. Warsami, if a jury saw that evidence that I just told you, would they find you guilty? And he said yes. He did not ask Mr. Warsami, you saw in the video, you said, I'm possessing ammo. That was not asked Mr. Warsami. Mr. Warsami's yes answer was, if the jury saw what the state is claiming this video shows, he would be convicted. He did not acknowledge that's what the video shows, and the judge was never permitted to review that video. The evidence was not presented. The basis for a Norgaard plea is and an Alford plea. Require the defendant to acknowledge the evidence that will be used against him at trial. The preferred method of doing this is for the state to present what evidence would be at trial. They should present the video and say, Your Honor, for your consideration, you may review the video. It's in evidence, or the criminal complaint. But even a review of every document, every piece of evidence in the record in this case before you, still doesn't amount to a sufficient factual basis.
Now, that would still be new law, though, wouldn't it? I mean, in other words, and it doesn't cite the State versus Johnson, it gets to what I'm getting at, is there's no obligation for the evidence to be submitted to the court for independent review in a Norgaard or Alford plea, correct? I understand there has to be a strong factual basis, but when we're dealing with a defendant who's pled not guilty, or guilty by means of a Norgaard plea, and then is asked the question, the routine question, you understand the charge, you understand the offense against you, and of course review all the rights, and then says there's a substantial likelihood I would be convicted, and that's all with the advice of counsel. It just seems to me those are the boxes that you check when you're a district court judge sentencing, and only if, as you point out, the judge is told at the hearing, or perhaps the post-conviction verdict type of proceeding where you want to develop the record, it would be, the whole record would look different. But I'm just not understanding what more the judge here would have had to do.
Your Honor, I would direct your attention to the Supreme Court opinion in Rosendahl v. State. That's a traditional plea case that discusses how you can supplement the record for a plea, but it also extensively goes into Norgaard pleas. And it states that looking to the record is mandatory in Alford or Norgaard pleas. And that's because the defendant is pleading guilty, not based on admitting guilt, but based on the factual record before it.
Right. And I wrote that opinion, so I'm familiar with it. The point being is that record has to support the Alford type of plea, whereas in a straight plea, it's the words of the defendant pleading guilty, and that's a different situation. So here we do have acknowledgement of the record being the police reports and the video. And so the question I had, and that was acknowledged by Mr. Warsami, I've looked at that evidence in the record, meaning me and my attorney together looked at the police reports and the video, and I'm, despite my lack of memory, of pleading guilty to it. So isn't that what Rosendahl's pointing out? That was done here. There's no obligation in every Alford or Norgaard-type plea for a record evidence to be submitted, but only that the defendants reviewed what would be submitted if there was a trial. Would that be an accurate statement of the law?
No, Your Honor, it would not be. And I would like to point out the footnote that you may have written in Rosendahl. It states that in Alford and Norgaard pleas, a defendant is required to acknowledge on the record during the plea hearing the evidence that supports guilt. Here, that was not done. There is no acknowledgement that the record supports his guilt. He does not acknowledge that this video supports the elements of this offense to the extent that it demonstrates a strong factual basis that would allow a district court to independently conclude that there's a substantial likelihood he'd be found guilty at trial. He made a statement negating intent. He said, I didn't know I was sitting next to ammunition. You consider the circumstances of this case, the fact that he was in someone else's room, on someone else's bed, the ammunition was sitting behind him. That's undisputed. And he states, I didn't know. Under all of the precedent, it's required.
Is it also undisputed that he had gun parts in his hand when the police came in?
Correct.
And that he made a statement to the police about the rifle and the ammo and that he was building the rifle and it wasn't worth doing 60 months over this?
No, Your Honor, that's exactly what's disputed, and that is what the issue with the accuracy here is. That long statement by the prosecutor mischaracterizes what the video shows. If you look to the complaint here.
Well, the video isn't in the record, is that
correct? That's
correct. I tried to find it and I couldn't find it.
Correct.
Okay.
But what is in the record is the complaint and the PSI. The complaint, which is actual evidence here. I see my time has run. May I briefly
you may
finish?
Answer. Certainly.
The complaint states that the defendant said he was building a rifle. The complaint says nothing about ammunition. The offense summary in the PSI says the exact same as the complaint. It says nothing about ammunition. The defendant's summary of the offense in the PSI says it was in someone else's room, it belonged to someone else, he thought it was a toy gun. It says nothing about ammunition. He is not convicted of possession of a firearm. He's convicted of knowingly possessing ammunition. And the factual basis for that is not strong, especially considering the statement he made that negated guilt. Thank you.
Counsel, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, you may approach, identify yourself, and proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Justina Zukowskaiti, and I am a certified student attorney. My supervising attorney, Nicole Cornell, is in the courtroom today. Together, we represent the state of Minnesota, respondent in the matter. This case regards appellant's Norgaard guilty plea to ineligible possession of ammunition. Appellant asserts that there was not a strong factual basis established in the record to support his plea, but the record belies this claim. This court should affirm appellant's conviction. And I'd like to do three things with my argument time this morning. First, I'd like to tell you why this Norgaard plea is established on a proper factual basis. Second, I'd like to talk about the I didn't know statement. And third, I'd like to talk about the knowing possession element in the record. So first, a valid Norgaard plea is required to be accurate, voluntary, and intelligent. Proper factual basis consists of two components, a strong factual basis and defendant's acknowledgement that the evidence would be sufficient for a jury to find them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, we have both. As to the first component, the strong factual basis, during the plea colloquy, appellant was questioned by his counsel and the state about the events at bar and about the evidence that the state was prepared to present at trial. Appellant specifically admitted that he had gun parts in his hand and the ammo next to him. That when police entered the room, they saw appellant holding the parts, and appellant made some statements to the police about the gun being a rifle, it was ammo, and he was not, it was not worth going to jail 60 months over it, which uncoincidentally is the jail time for this crime.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that he really only admitted to that evidence through leading questions, that he didn't independently describe the video, he didn't independently describe the evidence that the state had showed him? Instead, he was really just responding to leading questions, which are certainly, you know, disfavored in any kind of plea.
The response is that they are disfavored, but there hasn't been a case that has invalidated a Norgaard plea because leading questions were used. And as to the second component of a proper factual basis, the acknowledgement, appellant specifically conceded there was a substantial likelihood that a jury would find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's at plea hearing, page 13. So about this.
But with regard to that, his response to that question, I mean, he stated it in response to a question from the prosecutor, correct?
I believe so.
I think that was in response to a question where the prosecutor summarized what the video shows, and then the prosecutor said, so you understand that if the jury saw that evidence, there's a likelihood they would convict you of this offense? And the answer was yes.
Yes.
So going back to appellant's argument, appellant argues that in responding yes is a, and I'm not mischaracterizing appellant's argument, but as I understand it, appellant is arguing that Orsami wasn't acknowledging what the video showed.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, Orsami was agreeing that if that was what the video showed, that would be sufficient. And so what, if that is how one could read that answer, what evidence is there to provide a sufficient factual basis for the plea if you remove the answer to this question?
The acknowledgement, as to the acknowledgement component. So I do apologize. He does affirm to that on page 13, but he also affirms it on page 11 when the prosecutor asks him if the evidence came in against him, that there would be a substantial likelihood that a jury would find you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. He affirms there as well. So the point being that the record is full of his acknowledgments and affirmations to the fact that he would be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Does that answer?
And it does, but then I guess going back to your original point that you were making, whether there's sufficient evidence,
mm-hmm.
whether there's a sufficient factual basis for the Norgaard plea, if you take out his the response to that question on page 13, what evidence in the record supports the Norgaard plea? What factual basis in the record supports the Norgaard plea?
Sure. He specifically admitted that he had gun parts in his hand and ammo next to him. I think the most glaring piece of evidence is that he knew that he would be going to jail 60 months over what he was doing at that time. And, that indicates that he knew that he was a felon and that he wasn't supposed to have ammunition in his possession. That's the state's position that would establish a factual basis.
Counsel, in response to my question to the appellant about the record, it is true that the judge is obligated to find that there's a strong factual basis.
Mm-hmm.
Given the nature of that, and maybe the Supreme Court in a couple of cases are considering now might, it's not directly the issue, it doesn't seem like, but it might be part of the answer. If I understand correctly, but wouldn't it behoove a prosecutor to routinely submit the evidence into the record so that if there's doubt, such as this question that we're asking here, that at least raises a specter of doubt? Well, it could either be follow-up questions or the judge could adjourn and independently review it and then make some findings on the record, or as here, when it's first raised on direct appeal, we would look at it. Would the strong evidence part of the law behoove prosecutors to routinely submit that evidence?
Perhaps, but that is not the state of the law right now. I mean,
why isn't it? In other words, it's true there's no case that said do that, but obligating the strong evidence element and a judge to be sure that exists,
mm-hmm.
almost suggests, without directly saying, well, then we got to have the evidence to show that it's a strong evidence in these Norgaard or even Alford type pleas.
Yeah, right, but with this plea, appellant waived his right to a trial where the evidence would have been admitted. He certainly could have proceeded to trial, but he decided to go through with the guilty plea. And under Norgard, appellant only needs to reasonably believe that the state has sufficient evidence to obtain a conviction.
But how does the judge make that strong factual basis finding without seeing the evidence? Especially in these cases where it's a close call because of his equivocal answer.
The defendant affirms and acknowledges the evidence in the plea transcript, which is part of the record, which the court does take into consideration, the plea transcript. Is your question more about?
Well, it goes to the issue of the record and strong factual basis, and it just does seem logical in almost any other situation where a judge has to make that finding. The judge needs to see the record rather than just hear it.
Right. I would say that the defendant waived his right to a trial where the evidence would have been admitted. I mean, at a plea hearing, evidence is not. It is not required for evidence to be admitted to the court. Does that
It does. I mean, that's kind of why I was asking appellant, and she referred to the State versus Johnson. That's my understanding, too. There's no explicit case, but what we do have is the strong factual evidence, and my only question is, wouldn't that behoove a prosecutor, because the prosecutor wants this deal to go through as obviously as well, and then when it comes on appeal to be affirmed, to submit that? And your answer is there's no law requiring it. I understand that, other than strong factual basis, and a judge needs to determine that, and it seems hard to do without the actual record being present.
Yeah, so I would just point you to the acknowledgments and affirmations on the part of appellant in this case, where he agreed that there would be a substantial likelihood that a jury would find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. He affirmed all of these things that the police saw when they entered the room. It was a rifle, it was ammo, he was building it, and it wasn't worth doing 60 months over, which is the strong factual basis that the judge can go off of.
Thank you.
So second, I'd like to talk about this I didn't know statement. So he retracted the I didn't know and corrected himself on his own accord. This does not show that he didn't know at the time of the crime. And there's really two ways to look at the statement. You can look at it as not being a claim of innocence on the element, because immediately after stating I didn't know, again, appellant agreed that he told the police at the time that it was a gun, it was ammo, I was building it, and it wasn't worth doing 60 months over. Or it could be viewed as a claim of innocence, but a disingenuous or ambiguous one. Disingenuous because he had already submitted a plea petition and Norgard addendum to the district court, in which he stated, I do not recall the circumstances of the offense, and I do not claim that I was innocent. And ambiguous because it could be that appellant meant between the night of the offense, when he was intoxicated, and when he reviewed the evidence, he didn't know it was ammo. This doesn't mean that he didn't know at the time of the offense. Appellant argues that the single statement undermines his entire plea and negates the knowing element of ineligible possession. So I would say that this plea still meets the definition of a Norgard. In order for it to be a Norgard, he must assert an absence of memory on the elements of the offense, which he did. And as to negating the knowing element, Norgard case law allows a defendant to plead guilty without expressing the requisite intent element. He was not required to make specific admissions regarding each element of ineligible possession. And furthermore, the rest of his plea is filled with his acknowledgments and detailed admissions that he could not remember the facts. So lastly, I would like to talk about the knowing possession element in the record, which we argue that it is established. Appellant argues that the record does not establish the knowing possession element of the crime, but indeed it does. He was critically thinking and he had foresight at the time. Appellant identified the ammunition to police. He explained that he was building it. He knew enough about what he was doing.
Appellant argues that in fact, there isn't any evidence in the record regarding the ammunition, pointing to the fact that the complaint talks about the rifle, but it doesn't talk about ammunition. Can you point to anywhere in the record of the plea hearing outside of his statements that he's outside of the transcript mm-hmm. where he's acknowledged the ammunition as opposed to just the rifle?
So we would argue that what is in the transcript is enough, but...
I guess, do you agree with appellant that in the PSI and in the complaint, it's targeted at the firearm as opposed to the ammunition? His statements about what he was possessing.
The complaint outlines that he did say that it was a rifle, it was ammo, he was building it, and it wasn't worth doing 60 months over. But again...
Doesn't the complaint say that it wasn't worth going to prison for 60 months for the rifle?
I don't know the answer to that question exactly. I don't have the complaint in front of me, so I wouldn't be able to answer that at the moment. But again, we would argue that it is enough. What is in the plea, him acknowledging the fact that it was ammo is enough at the plea hearing.
Could I inquire where either the complaint or the PSI acknowledged by the defendant during his plea and or offered into evidence as part of the plea hearing?
I'm sorry, what was the
question? Was either the complaint or the PSI acknowledged in terms of its truthfulness by appellant, or was it offered into evidence separately during the plea hearing?
The complaint was not acknowledged by the defendant.
Nor the PSI.
Nor the PSI.
Okay, thank you.
For similar reasons that the I didn't know statement doesn't negate the knowing element of ineligible possession, the knowing possession element is established in the record. And so if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll briefly conclude. Appellant has not met his burden to show his Norgaard plea was invalid because it was inaccurate. The record shows his plea was supported by a strong factual basis, and this court should affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Respondent's counsel repeatedly states that appellant agreed that he told police he possessed ammo. That is simply not true. That is a misstatement of the record. We've already discussed why that the prosecutor's characterization of what a video would show, his summary, is not accurate as far as the rest of the record is concerned. It contradicts with the complaint. The prosecutor's statement is not evidence in the record in support of the defendant's plea unless it's adopted by the defendant.
Well, with regard to that argument, and I understood your argument during the initial argument about that question, that it was in your view, it's the prosecutor characterizing the video and Wishsami acknowledging that if that is what the video shows, then the evidence would be sufficient, or there's a likelihood that the jury would convict him of the offense. But if you look earlier in the transcript on page 12, 11 and 12, it talks about there's some discussion about the video, and Morsami acknowledges that he reviewed the video, and then there's a question on 12 that the prosecutor says, all right, and the video shows, this is starting at line 10, that when police came to talk to you and there was an ammo clip and the video shows that when the police came to talk to you that there was an ammo clip that was sitting on the bed right behind you, correct? And he says, correct. And there was a .322 caliber shells in there, question mark, correct, is the answer. And then we have the question on page, so that's page 12. So he's agreeing with the officer's characterization of the video. And then we have, and that he says he's seen the video. And then we have the question that you pointed us to starting on line 11. And the officer says the video shows the police coming in, sitting on the bed, you holding the parts, and then goes on to talk about the statement about the rifle, the ammo, building it, and it's not worth doing 60 months over this or what you were doing. So when you read the whole back and forth in context and you read that last question in context, or the discussion of the prosecutor's characterization of the video and then the question about you understand that if the jury saw that evidence, there's a likelihood that they would convict you of this. When you read it all together, doesn't it suggest that that the prosecutor's saying this is what the video shows and he's agreeing, yes, that's what the video shows, and if the jury saw that the evidence, there's a likelihood that they would convict him of the offense?
No, Your Honor, it does not. You can see that he does adopt the prosecutor's, or it's actually his defense attorney that asks him what the video shows initially.
Oh, you're
on
right.
11.
Yes.
And he does adopt that statement. He admits that the video shows he's on the bed and there's an ammo clip sitting on the bed right behind him. Is that what the video shows? Correct? Correct. And there were three .22 caliber shells in there. Correct. He's admitting that's what the video shows. The question from the prosecutor saying, so the video shows police coming in, sitting on the bed, you're holding the parts. And then when you're talking with police, you make some statements to them about it was a rifle, it was ammo, you were building it. It's not worth doing 60 months over this or what you were doing. So you understand if the jury saw that evidence, there's a substantial likelihood you'd be found guilty of this offense. Yes. Now, English is not Mr. Warsami's first language. This is a compound question, and it is the prosecutor's characterization of this video. It is the first time ever in any part of this record where him talking about ammo is ever mentioned. That is the prosecutor's statement, not Mr. Warsami's. Mr. Warsami did not adopt the prosecutor's claim that he made some statements to them about it was ammo. That's just simply not the case. And again, that is why it is so important to have a strong factual basis with these types of pleas. And this is not a case where we don't have evidence regarding intent. We have a specific statement negating intent. This makes this case different than State v. Ecker, where the Supreme Court affirmed the plea withdrawal of the denial of the plea withdrawal of a Norgard plea. I see my time has run. May I briefly respond or briefly conclude?
You may.
In Ecker, they said the record established that the evidence was sufficient to convince a jury of his guilt. In Ecker, he didn't admit he had the requisite intent. It was silent to intent. But a review of the entire record and what he did admit to allowed them, reviewing the record, to say this was a strong factual basis on intent. We don't have that here. We have a statement negating intent, and that needed to be cured in order to present a strong factual basis. What we have here is convoluted, leading questions that do not establish a strong factual basis for the offense. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. You all have a good day.